Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Mental Diseases for Days. This is Zamira, and I'm a second year at Reed College, joined with my partner here, Serby.
Hi, y'all. Today we're going to be talking about a mental condition that isn't really well understood, schizophrenia. Specifically, in regards to a really cool paper that we read, titled Evidence from Imaging Resilience Genetics for a Protective Mechanism Against Schizophrenia in the Ventral Visual Pathway.
Wow, now that's a mouthful. So the paper basically talks about the genetic and neurobiological mechanisms in regards to developing schizophrenia and being resistant through genetics to developing schizophrenia.
Before that, let's discuss what exactly is schizophrenia and what we previously know about the cause of schizophrenia before the study was published.
So, schizophrenia, as you mentioned earlier, is a mental condition in which the person diagnosed with it can experience auditory or visual hallucinations and delusions, as well as impaired motivation, reduction in spontaneous speech, social withdrawal, cognitive impairment, and psychosis. Schizophrenia, to the best of our knowledge, seems to be caused by the dysfunction of overexpressive dopaminergic neurotransmission, but there is also evidence that points to an issue of widespread and variable involvement of other brain areas and circuits.
Most importantly, thanks to prior research, we know that there are many different types of schizophrenia, such as paranoid schizophrenia, which is basically hallucinations and delusions, hebephrenic schizophrenia, which is disorganized behaviors, and catatonic schizophrenia, which is the rarest form of schizophrenia because that causes spontaneous movement.
What is particularly interesting about this disease is that the age of onset ranges from around 16 to 30 years old. The common treatments for schizophrenia include administration of antipsychotic drugs and combination of psychological therapy, social support, and rehabilitation.
Speaking of interesting facts, did you know that 1% of the population will develop schizophrenia? It's a small portion of our population, but 2.2 million people is a lot of people.
And that makes it so much more important to have a better understanding of the neurobiological mechanisms of schizophrenia so that it can be treated more effectively.
Well, Zamira, that's why we're here talking about it. Having young scientists like ourselves discuss these topics definitely reduces the stigma around it. And at the same time, we're educating people about schizophrenia.
Now, before we start talking specifically about the paper, we'd like to bring you to our annual fun fact. Today's extra special because we've got a fact about twins. So, there was this Danish study that studied identical and fraternal twins who had elder family members with a predisposition for schizophrenia.
That's right. Now we know that if you're an identical twin, you and your twin have the exact same genetic makeup. So this should mean that if identical twins both have the same genetics to inherit schizophrenia, that they both should develop it, right?
Actually, that is not completely true. Even though identical twins share the same genetic makeup, there is around a 33% chance that only one of them will develop schizophrenia in their life. The development of schizophrenia not only depends on how likely you are to inherit resilience factors from your ancestors, but how your body expresses those genetic resilience factors.
Wow, that's actually super cool! So let's actually talk about the paper that we mentioned earlier. What exactly did the researchers want to find out? Like, what was the goal?
Well, lead researcher Dr. Mika D. Hetwer, who is a doctoral candidate at the Max Planck School of Cognition, and her other researchers aim to compare the brains of people who have schizophrenia to people who have resilience genetics towards developing schizophrenia. They compared the visual area of the brain, more specifically the fusiform gyrus. This was to gain further understanding of the nature of these genetic resilience factors to schizophrenia and to better understand the physical abnormalities in the brain of someone with schizophrenia.
So, hold on now. Before going any further, let's clear up some terms for our listeners. What exactly is the fusiform gyrus, Zamira?
Great question! So the fusiform gyrus sends important information between brain areas that aid in visual interpretation. It helps identify objects and other images coming from the visual input.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. Now let's go back to the study. And before we dive into the details of the study, we need to understand why the researchers chose to compare resilience genes that were specifically aimed at the pathways in the brain that interpret visual information.
To start off, the functional role of the visual area of the brain is to sort out visual information by categorizing it as either social or non-social. More specifically, the ventral visual pathway, which is also in the visual area of the brain, is mostly involved in object recognition and categorization. Along this pathway, the fusiform gyrus sends information to higher and lower regions of the visual area. The way that various brain regions in the visual area are connected, the effectiveness and stability of this communication between different brain regions in the visual area are extremely crucial to have the ability to accurately shape objects and recognize faces.
Now, digging a little deeper into the biology of schizophrenia, clinical and cognitive symptoms of schizophrenia actually stem from the brain making inaccurate models and interpretations of the environment. And these predictions of errors will lead to having incorrect projections about thoughts, movements, and emotions, which are thought to present as hallucinations and delusions in people with schizophrenia. It's really important to keep in mind, though, that brains make incorrect interpretations and predictions of the environment all the time. But the difference between a schizophrenic and a non-schizophrenic brain is that someone without schizophrenia quickly adapts to making errors in predicting a visual stimulus.
Now, let's say, for example, someone sees a weird-looking shadow that looks creepy, like a monster. But then a squirrel comes into view, and you quickly realize it was a squirrel shadow, and it only looked distorted because of the odd angle of light that was projecting onto the squirrel. Someone with schizophrenia might look at the weird shadow, and their brain might project it as a shadow that belongs to an actual monster. The shadow might make noises, even though there aren't any noises being made, and might even move in directions that the squirrel isn't moving in. Even when the squirrel comes into view, their brain might not correct their mistaken interpretation, and still see the shadow as a shadow that doesn't belong to the squirrel.
That seems like a very stressful reality to live in. But unfortunately, people with schizophrenia also face other daily challenges due to their brain not being able to interpret information effectively. For example, they have an inability to store memories of sensory information well. It is also important to note that their visual pathway of the brain is also very unstable, with certain processes including the ability to interpret shapes and details at a given distance, contrast, sensitivity, segregating objects from a background, detecting motion, detecting object boundaries, perceiving an incomplete object as whole, and higher level processes like object recognition and other higher order cognitive aspects like short-term memory and social cognition. This contributes to the consequence of not being able to function effectively due to these visual processing issues and distortions.
Now that we have a better understanding of how the visual system is impaired in people with schizophrenia, it's also important to understand what genetic resilience is. Since this study compares genetic resilience, or more specifically PRS resilience, which stands for polygenic resilience score schizophrenia, to the size of brain structures in the visual area.
So, think of the concept of PRS resilience like your overall grade for a class. You take the average grade of all your assignments, like you would calculate the genes that determine PRS resilience. And some assignments are weighted more than others, just like some genes are more significant in terms of strengthening the ventral visual pathway than others. Your final grade for the class is that average. PRS resilience is that score for assessing the genetics that will strengthen the visual ventral pathway. If you have a higher passing score, you have strong resilience genetics to schizophrenia, a strengthened visual ventral pathway, and increased surface area and volume in the fusiform gyrus. In other words, you have a less likely chance of developing schizophrenia. If you don't obtain a passing score, you have weak resilience genetics, an unstable ventral visual pathway, and decreased surface area and volume in the fusiform gyrus. In other words, you are at a higher risk for developing schizophrenia.
It's also important to note that the researchers technically did not identify these genes on their own. They followed the procedure given by the literature by Hess et al., in which a generalizable framework is given to find resilience genetics for any complex heritable disorder. That paper specifically used that framework to identify people without schizophrenia who are at high polygenic risk for schizophrenia and contrast them with people that have schizophrenia, and generated the first polygenic resilience score. To make a long story short, The guidelines for identifying the resilience genes are primarily performing a genome-wide association analysis of people with and without schizophrenia and preparing the polygenic risk score formula, and then applying the formula to the participants' genetics in order to calculate their polygenic risk scores. Then they define the resilient individuals by identifying the section of DNA that accounts for the most variance in not expressing schizophrenia. Lastly, they derived the resilience scores and replicated the analysis with a subset of the original participants. The research team of the main study we are discussing about today obtained PRS resilience scores so that the participants' PRS resilience score can be compared to the participants' cortical volume and surface area to multiple areas in the brain, more specifically in the fusiform gyrus, and comparing these differences in people with and without schizophrenia. Lastly, it's also important to keep in mind that in order to analyze the participants' DNA, blood samples were collected from each participant.
Another important technique used was SMRI. SMRI is really fascinating if you think about it. It stands for Structural Magnetic Resonance Imaging, and it's a machine that uses a magnetic field and computer-generated radio waves to create images of organs and tissues in your body, which is commonly used to look at the brain and examine the anatomical structures of the brain. Through SMRI, the researchers were able to locate the right and left fusiform gyrus, as well as calculate the volume of specific brain areas and surface area through this technique.
Whoa, that's pretty cool. Out of curiosity, do you know if an SMRI and CAT scan are similar? Because I know that CAT scans can be used to retrieve pictures of different regions of the brain, too.
Actually, they both essentially perform the same thing, but obtain different kinds of pictures. CAT scans are better for finding skull and facial fractures, whereas SMRI is a bit more sensitive and helps identify damages to brain cells.
That is really fascinating to think about. Okay, now going back to the study, if it wasn't already given away by our previous analogy, the researchers found that people with high PRS resilience scores also had increased cortical volume and surface area in the right fusiform gyrus and volume in the left fusiform gyrus.
Connecting these findings further, interestingly, resilience to schizophrenia appears as a result from a general increase in processing resources in visual pathways in the brain. Through the increased volume of both the left and right fusiform gyrus, this shows that there are more resources placed towards processing multiple facets of visual information. In terms of predicting events and visual information, this also means that there are greater resources placed towards differentiating sensory evidence from emphasizing what has already been learned and stored in the brain's world model. Recalling our squirrel shadow analogy, this means that more resources will be put towards storing the memory of that prediction error efficiently and towards correcting the mistake of interpretation of the shadow if you have a fusiform gyrus with increased volume.
And as mentioned before, people with schizophrenia are impaired in their ability to use stored knowledge to interpret sensory evidence. Therefore, the embedding of sensory evidence in the context of previous sensory experiences are disturbed. Because of this, a larger fusiform gyrus can compensate for the disturbances that disturb the evaluation of sensory information that requires context from your brain's world model and predictions based on that world model.
They also noted that a larger fusiform gyrus might also contribute to having an enhanced ability to integrate information coming from various parts of the brain, facilitating various facets of perceptual organization during multiple stages of object processing, which is significantly impaired in people with schizophrenia, hence having a smaller fusiform gyrus.
In addition, perceptual deficits like having difficulty decoding complex facial configurations accompany and most likely occur before issues with decision-making. The researchers' data also points to the fact that PRS resilience might facilitate social perceptual processing capacities, meaning that having a larger fusiform gyrus will work efficiently with relaying information about social perceptions.
So, all of these interpretations are supported by the fact that there are reports of increased fusiform gyrus volume in people with schizophrenia that participate in cognitive training to improve general neuro and social cognition.
This leads to my point that social cognition for resilience to schizophrenia is a major predictor of functional outcome and makes up for the negative effects of neurocognitive deficits on daily life. Thus, fusiform gyrus resilience mechanisms enhance cognitive functions which facilitate the embedding of individuals in their social environment, thus assisting against the effects of risk factors of schizophrenia.
Expanded computational resources in the visual pathways of the brain should also facilitate coping with stressors resulting from sensory deficits. Usually, resilience models emphasize the ability to cope with stressors such as challenging life circumstances and physical illness. But distorted visual information processing in people with schizophrenia might in and of itself be considered a stressor.
Wow, you were right about what you said earlier. This does sound totally stressful to deal with these symptoms every day. In addition, if you were to have schizophrenia, you would already experience disturbances from your daily condition. So you have a lower threshold for other stressors like sensory overload, visual distortions, and you would already have a reduced predictability of changes in the environment, which results in uncertainty regarding appropriate behavior and leads to psychotic experiences.
This obviously in turn leads to consequences such as detrimental effects on adaptive behavior and interpersonal interactions, which together work as a fundamental stressor. This leads to a vicious cycle of increasing psychological stress, abnormal information processing, and psychosis proneness. Through increased perceptual and cognitive abilities, the resilience mechanism should be able to reduce stress induced by perceptual impairments and increase the chances of interrupting the cycle.
Notably, it is still unclear if increased resources in the fusiform gyrus promote a resilience mechanism that directly stops cognitive disturbances, or if it compensates for the cognitive disturbances from schizophrenia. Although the theory that it mitigates cognitive deficits by compensating for the abnormalities that schizophrenia presents is consistent with the idea that on the neurobiological level, resilience doesn't reverse the pathological processes, but it reduces the impact of the harmful consequences of those stressors.
Those two theories are quite different, but I can see how the latter hypothesis makes sense. After all, we're talking about genetic resilience mechanisms, and not genetic prevention mechanisms. This leads to the next part of our talk in regards to the current treatment methods for schizophrenia. It is especially important to talk about this because the current treatment methods that target the previously known causes of schizophrenia clearly aren't effective at improving the quality of life for the patients currently with schizophrenia.
It's very concerning that more than 50% of individuals who receive a diagnosis have intermittent long-term psychiatric problems. Unemployment for individuals with schizophrenia is also at a staggering statistic of 80 to 90%, and life expectancy is reduced by 10 to 20%. Why do you think that is so?
Well, it could be that there isn't that great of a support system for those who are diagnosed with this. The lack of support has been shown to lead to patients having suicidal ideations.
A direct cause and solid understanding of the mechanisms that cause schizophrenia have not necessarily been defined. It's concerning that the diagnosis of schizophrenia is based only by the family and personal history of the patient and an examination of their mental state. There are no diagnostic tests or biomarkers that are available to use as a diagnostic for schizophrenia. To make matters worse, only the syndromic concept of schizophrenia exists, meaning that schizophrenia is really only identified through symptoms and not through a concrete biological understanding. Although it has been known that there is a strong genetic component to inheriting schizophrenia, in terms of inheriting it from biological parents, this has been known from the 1960s. The complexity of these genetics are weakly understood, as we know from earlier studies, like mentioned before, the Danish twin study.
Another big thing is that most medications prescribed for schizophrenia target blocking the dopaminergic receptors, specifically the D2 receptors. This medication is specifically called dexmedetomidine. For example, there is a generalized medication for agitation in people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder 1 and 2. The medication does the same thing for people with both diseases. It's just so crazy how we don't know specialized medications required for schizophrenia and how we depend on generalized ones This just shows how little scientists know about schizophrenia.
I know, right? Additionally, when a person has chronic stress for long periods of time, it would cause a huge multitude of additional problems. That is a lot for one person to go through on their own.
That is very true. So as much as we'd like to continue our talk, it looks like that is all we have for today's podcast. Thank you for tuning in to Mental Diseases for Days, and we'll see you next time.